Okay, the outline you should have in front of you is called the Wife of Jehovah and the Bride of Messiah, the Bride of Christ. As I previously mentioned, a couple of our sessions this week is that in the 4th century, replacement theology became the dominant theology, and although it's lost a lot of ground over the years, even today, it is still the dominant position of the majority of the visible church today, and in more recent decades it's been growing again. Now the theology that actually launched a specific war against replacement theology is traditionally known as dispensationalism or dispensational theology, which holds to a clear premillennial position. But I might point out, there are other theologies that hold to a premillennial position, and as while the majority of replacement theologians are amill, do not believe in the future messianic kingdom, there is a minority among them that believes in a premillennial return of the Messiah, that he'll come and set up a kingdom. But in their system, Israel does not play a major role in that kingdom. So on board you can have, say, covenantal premillennialism and the dispensational premillennialism. The difference is dispensationalism has a leading role for Israel because they take the Bible literally, whereas the other forms of premillennialism focus very little about Israel and it's mostly upon the church. Now, what distinguishes dispensation theology primarily are two key elements. First of all, a consistent, literal interpretation of Scripture, thus the text requires something non-literal. And a dispensational interpreter will never begin assuming something is symbolic. The text itself must clearly indicate that it's symbolic, otherwise they take it quite literally. Now, all theologies do take some of the Bible quite literally. But the difference with dispensational theology is they are more consistent in their approach to literal interpretation of what the Bible says. A second key element comes from the first one, is that dispensationalism also makes a consistent distinction between Israel and the church, whereas other theologies somehow mix the two at certain points in their theology. I do my dissertation research for New York University, which became the book Israelology, and reading replacement theology books that kept on saying the church is Israel, I decided to look up every single passage in the New Testament that uses the term Israel. And not once is the term used of the church. It is sometimes used of Jewish people in general, sometimes more specifically of Jewish believers, but never it's used of the church. And so I'm going to go ahead and list all of the passages in chapter 10 of that work. Now, one of the ways you can see this distinction between Israel and the church is what we're going to cover tonight, where Israel is portrayed the wife of Jehovah and the church is portrayed as the bride of the Messiah. And replacement theologians have a real problem with this. They keep insisting it's all the same woman, but as we shall see, was described of Israel and was described of the church that cannot possibly be the one and the same woman. Looking on the outline then, we come to Roman numeral 1. We'll focus on Israel, the wife of Jehovah, undergo 6 specific stages. Let's begin with stage 1 and turn to the book of Deuteronomy chapter 5. The book of Deuteronomy chapter 5. But people notice after reading the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, they come to this 5th book of Moses and notice that it seems to repeat much of the history and many of the commandments already found in the 3 previous books. And that's the reason for the name Deuteronomy. It's not a Hebrew name. The Hebrew name is quite different than the Greek name. But it's a combination of 2 Greek words meaning a second law or repetition of the law. Second law or repetition of the law. That's the Christian name for the book, not the Jewish name. But if all we see is merely repetition, fiction, we're missing the point that Moses was making, because two things are happening. On one hand, the outline of the book of Deuteronomy is the same outline in what they found in archaeology in what is called the vassal and suzerain treaties. Suzerain-vassal treaties. So the king conquered new territory, he was the suzerain. The new people conquered would be the vassals, and there would be a covenantal arrangement between the conquering king and the vassals. And this follows in some places a 5-point outline and sometimes a 6-point outline. And the book of Deuteronomy follows that outline of a suzerain-vassal treaty. Also, however, it's also in some elements also is mimicking a marriage covenant, a marriage contract. That's the focus we'll be dealing with, not so much the suzerain-vassal treaty, but the concept of this being a marriage covenant, and we shall see the prophets view this as a marriage covenant. In chapter 5, verse 1, and Moses called unto all Israel, and said unto them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak in your ears this day, that ye may learn them and observe to do them. Jehovah God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Jehovah made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day. And he points out that this is a covenant distinct from the other previous Jewish covenants, like the Abrahamic covenant. This was made at the Mount of Sinai. And as we shall see, when the prophets look at this book, they see it as a marriage relationship, a marriage covenant. Look at chapter 10, verse 6. Excuse me, chapter 6, verse 10. Not 10, 6, but 6, 10. And verse 10 says of chapter 6, It shall be when Jehovah your God shall bring you into land which he sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you great and goodly cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, cisterns hewn out which you did not hew, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you shall eat and be full. Then beware, lest you forget Jehovah who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall fear Jehovah your God, and him shall you serve. You shall swear by his name. You shall not go after other gods of the gods of the peoples around about you. For Jehovah your God in the midst of you is a jealous God, lest the anger of Jehovah your God be kindled against you, and he destroys you from off the face of the land. Now, what he points out is that in verses 10 to 15, that is God who brings this land, this people of Israel, into this promised land. They not have yet entered into it, but they soon will be. But he wants them to be very careful against committing adultery. And the means of committing adultery is by means of idolatry. And of all the good and bad and worse sins of the Bible, the worst sin is the sin of idolatry, the worship of some other god than the one who is true. And he points out, if they fall into adultery, spiritual adultery, God's jealousy will burn against them. In English, we use the term jealous mostly in a negative sense, but in classical Hebrew, it could be either negative or positive, depending on the context. And the good part of jealousy is exercising the right of ownership. Exercising the right of ownership. And if the right of ownership is violated, then the righteous jealousy will arise. And Israel is God's wife, and therefore he'll be jealous for his wife. And therefore they must be very careful to stay true and not deviate from following him. Then chapter 7, verse 6, For you are a holy people unto Jehovah your God. Jehovah your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession above all peoples upon the face of the earth. Jehovah did not set his love upon you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all peoples. Because Jehovah loved you and because he would keep the oath which he swore unto your fathers, has Jehovah brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that Jehovah your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and loving kindness with them that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations and repays them that hates him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack to him that hates him. He will repay him to his face. You shall therefore keep the commandment and the statutes and the ordinances which I command you this day to do them. Notice it was God who chose Israel. Israel did not choose God. The question I sometimes get in the Q&A sessions is, why did God pick the Jews? Often it's with a certain negative tone. When this negative tone is there, my first answer is because God knows what he's doing. But the picture is not that the Jews were already there and then God chose them. That's not how it happened. God chose one man, Abraham. He made a new nation through Abraham. But the choosing was based upon the Abrahamic covenant, and the choice was made even before Abraham had any children that were of the covenant line. And so he did not choose a people already here. He chose them before they came into being. And also the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob become members of the chosen people. And he points out in verse 6, he did the choosing. In verses 7 and 8, he gives the reason for it, not because of their size, they were quite minuscule compared to other peoples, but because he loved them and because of his covenantal relationship and because he intends to keep the covenant he made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That is why their descendants are the chosen people, not because of any merit, but simply because of predetermined about national descendancy. And their obligation in verses 9 through 11 is one of faithfulness. One of faithfulness. Now turn to Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16. Well, look at one example and notice when Ezekiel talks about this thing, he views it as a marriage relationship. Chapter 16 of Ezekiel, verse 8, 16 verse 8. Now, when I passed by you and looked upon you, behold, your time was the time of love. I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. Yet I swore unto you and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord Jehovah, and you became mine. And the terminology used here is the terminology of the wedding night. He uses the wedding night terminology to express the relationship of God and Israel, a relationship of husband and wife. And so the marriage covenant occurred at Mount Sinai. That's when the people of Israel became the nation of Israel, but also at the same time she became the wife of Jehovah. Although these admonitions was to faithfulness under capital B, there came the second stage, the stage of the great adultery. Let's turn now to Jeremiah 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 1. Jeremiah 3, verse 1. They say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him, and become another man's, will he return unto her again? Will not thy land be greatly polluted? But you have played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, says Jehovah. Lift up your eyes unto the bare heights and see. Where have you not been lain with? By the way, you have set for them as an Arab in the wilderness, and you have polluted the land with your whoredoms and with your wickedness. Therefore, the showers have been withholden, and there's been no latter rain. Yet you have a harlot's forehead, and you refuse to be ashamed. Will you not from this time cry unto me, my father, you are the God of my youth? Will he retain his anger forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, you have spoken and have done evil things and has had your way. And he points out that Israel became guilty of becoming an adulterous wife and a very frequent adulterous wife, moving into worship of other gods, which was viewed by scripture as spiritual adultery. So in verse 20, he says, that's chapter 3, verse 20 of Jeremiah, surely as the wife treacherously departs from her husband, So have you dealt treacherously with me, O house of Israel, says Jehovah. Notice the comparison. Just as the human level, a wife can be committing adultery against her husband, by the same token, Israel, the wife has been guilty of adultery against her husband. And we shall see later in Jeremiah 31, verse 32, Jeremiah 31, verse 32, if the marriage had been violated, had been broken. Now we'll go back to Ezekiel chapter 16. We're going back between Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and the book of Hosea. So kind of get well versed where those books are. Ezekiel chapter 16. Now the great adultery is detailed in verses 15 through 34. Verses 15 through 34, chapter 16. I will not take time to read all this. Let me bring out the 6 points it makes. First of all, in verse 15, he makes a declaration. You played the role of a harlot, the role of a prostitute. Now, normally, prostitutes receive payment for their services, but his second point in verses 16 to 19. 16 to 19, she was unusual. She paid her lovers. What did she pay them with? She paid them with the very things her true husband gave her. So husband was the one that gave her the productivity of the land, and she was to give back a portion of the first fruits to her husband, but instead she began to use these things and with the worship of the other gods, and the first fruits were given to gods and goddesses. So thirdly, in verses 20 and 21, you also sacrificed your children to your lovers. At times they were guilty of human sacrifice. So fourthly, in verse 22, it says, you forgot the first love of your youth. You have forgotten the first love of your youth. Then fifthly, in verses 23 to 29, he begins to list the lovers with whom she commits adultery with. What's interesting is this. The very people who did her the most damage, she begins to worship the gods and goddesses of those very people. The Egyptians did damage to Israel, and so she worships the gods of the Egyptians. The Assyrians did a damage, and so she worships the gods of the Assyrians. The Babylonians did a lot of harm to him. She worships the god of the Babylonians. And so she commits adultery with the nations who, with the gods whose nations did her the most harm. So sixthly, in verses 30 to 34, he again repeats, she practices the kind of harlotry that has to pay to receive her lovers. Now look at the first minor prophet, Hosea chapter 2. Sometimes God asks the prophet to play a role as a pictorial role for the people. Some prophets have to play only certain roles for certain periods of time, but for other prophets, they play almost a lifetime role. And God asked Hosea to marry a prostitute that will be faithful to him for a while, produce children, but then she'll fall away and go back into a life of harlotry. And this is something Hosea had to accept. God asked him to marry and also told him up front, you will not have a happy marriage. And your wife will not be faithful. It becomes a pictorial lesson for Israel as a whole. So in chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, notice three things. In verses 2 and 3, he declares she's committed adultery. As a result, in verse 4, she's no longer producing legitimate children, but illegitimate children, the children of adultery. And in verse 5, he says, you are guilty of playing the harlot. In this case, she did it for pay. This period of the great adultery, sometimes she paid, sometimes she got paid. That would lead to the next stage, capital C in your outline, the stage of separation. And we'll look at this in Isaiah 50, chapter 50 of Isaiah. In the marriage covenant book of Deuteronomy says, if you're faithful, God will provide rains in the seasons, the land will be productive. But once, if she's disobedient and adulterous, then God will hold, her husband would withhold many of the material blessings he had promised her. Now we're in chapter 50, verse 1. Thus says Jehovah, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement? Where would I have put her away? Or to which of my creditors is to have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities were you sold, and for your transgressions was your mother put away. Because of the withholding of material benefits in the time of Isaiah, a rumor was spread that God had divorced his wife. The question now is, if God had divorced his wife, where is the bill of divorcement? Because in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, the way that a husband divorces his wife is to write out a bill of divorce and hand it to her, and then the divorce is complete. So if God has divorced Israel, where is the bill of divorcement that does not yet exist? So Israel was suffering a period of separation as God was waiting for Israel to come out of her adult relationship. But divorce had not yet taken place. And the period of separation lasted for about a century or so. But then came capital D, and you've outlined the divorce. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 3. Now when Israel was one nation, God sees himself being married to one wife, but when the kingdom split, God sees himself being married to two sisters. There's an old chapter on this in Ezekiel chapter 23. And notice in this contrast, chapter 3 of Jeremiah verse 6, Jeremiah 3 verse 6, moreover, Jehovah said to me in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen that which backsliding Israel has done? She's gone up upon every high mountain under every green tree, and there has played the harlot. Now said, after she had done all these things, she will return unto me, but she returned not. And her treacherous sister saw it. And I saw when for this very cause that backsliding Israel has committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorcement. Her treacherous Judah, her sister feared not, for also went and played the harlot. And it came to pass to the lightness of her whoredom that the land was polluted. She committed adultery and with stones and with stocks, and yet for all this her treacherous sister Judah had not returned unto me with her whole heart, but faintedly, says Jehovah. He points out that in the course of time, being married to two sisters, God finally divorced one sister, and that was Israel. And the book of Hosea is God's bill of divorcement for the northern kingdom. The book of Hosea is God's bill of divorcement for the northern kingdom. But Jeremiah becomes the bill of divorcement for the southern kingdom, for Judah. And with Jeremiah, you have the second bill of divorcement. Because although Judah saw what was happening to Israel, she did not learn the lesson of Israel. So the first four of these six stages are now history. What we have in the fourth and the fifth stage is the period of punishment that's continued to this very day. Let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 16. The context is verses 35 through 43, verses 35 through 43. And he'll make four specific points here. First of all, in verses 35 and 36, the basis of the judgment, the basis of the discipline is a spiritual adultery, her idolatry. But then secondly, in verses 37 through 41, they're being destroyed by the very nations whose gods and goddesses she worships. She worships the god of the Egyptians. God will use the Egyptians to punish her. She worships the gods of the Assyrians. He'll use the Assyrians to punish her. And the northern kingdom went into Assyrian captivity. She worships the god of Babylonians. God will then use Babylon to punish Israel. And the southern kingdom went into Babylonian captivity. She's destroyed by her very own lovers, by the nations who worships these gods and goddesses. So thirdly, in verse 42, it's by means of this severe discipline that God's jealousy is finally spent. But the purpose of the punishment is not for the sake of punishment per se. The purpose of punishment is to be disciplinary, to bring her back. And that's the point in verse 43. Verse 43 is the fourth point. The aim of punishment is to cause her to stop her sinning, to bring her back to himself. And later in verses 58 and 59, he points out that she's being punished for breaking the marital covenant. Verse 58, "You have borne your lewdness and your abomination, says Jehovah. For thus says the Lord Jehovah, also deal with you, as you have done, has despised the oath in breaking the covenant." In Ezekiel 16, that's the focus of being a marriage covenant. Let's go again to Hosea chapter 2. The full context is verses 6 to 13, Hosea chapter 2, verses 6 to 13. Again, he's focusing and trying to bring her back. So in verse 6 and 7, he maps out the punishment. In verse 6, he says, "A time will come when her pursuit of idolatry will be blocked by thorns, thistles, and wolves." So that in verse 7, there'll be a fruitless search for her lovers, searching them but cannot reach them or find them. And the aim of verse 7 is to show her need for a true husband, to show her need to go back to her first husband. End of verse 7. Then in verses 8 through 13, he describes the punishment. And in verses 8 and 9, he says this, that since she's been using the gifts her husband gave her as a means of worshiping these other gods and goddesses, God will now take away these visible physical benefits, so she has nothing to worship these other gods with. So in verse 8, these are the very gifts that were given by her husband, and in verse 9, they will now be taken away. So in verses 10 through 13, eventually she'll finally realize and come to realize her shame. In verse 10, she'll see herself as being spiritually naked. In verse 11, all of her mirth and joy will be removed. In verse 12, finally the harlot money she pays with will be removed. And she will finally see the tragedy in verse 13 of the days of the Baalim, because one of the key gods she worshipped is the god Baal or Baal, and Baalim is just the plural form of that word. Let's look at one more passage on the punishment factor and go to Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. Starts out in verses 11 through 13, chapter 3, 11 through 13, with the call to repentance, calling upon them, backsliding Israel, to return unto God, backsliding Judah also to return unto God. And what they have to do in verse 13 is only confess your iniquity that you have transgressed against Jehovah your God. And he then describes some of the various adulterous practices that she committed at the second part of verse 13. Now, should she return to him, then the blessings will return. And what he describes in verses 14 through 18 is the millennial blessings the Jewish people finally enjoy in the Messianic kingdom. And so in verse 14, he points out every Jew will be brought back one by one into the land of Israel. In verse 15, in that day, the God will give them righteous shepherds that will feed them with knowledge and understanding and never be guilty of leading the people astray. In verse 16, they won't so much as think of rebuilding the Ark of the Covenant, because in verse 17, God himself in visible form in the person of the Messiah will be ruling from the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 18, the Jews will be so reunited as not to be split into two Jewish kingdoms again. And these are the blessings Israel will enjoy, but the prerequisite is returning to her husband as the promise if they return. At the moment, we're still in the section of the period of punishment. But there's one more stage to go, and that's capital F on your outline, the remarriage with restored blessings. Now let's go to Jeremiah 31. Here you have Jeremiah's statement of the new covenant, which we made reference to in the previous meeting, times. But notice specifically in verse 31, with whom is the new covenant made? Behold, the days come, says Jehovah, I will make a new covenant with whom? The church? No, with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Furthermore, he points out in verse 32, it will be distinctive from the covenant he made with them when he brought them out of Egypt. That was the Mosaic covenant. Well, with whom did he make the Mosaic covenant? With the church? No, with Israel. And so the new covenant is made with the same people he made the Mosaic covenant, because the new covenant would be the replacement for the Mosaic covenant. As we already noted previously in verses 33 to 34, that will result in a reunion. And so just as the original marriage was based upon a covenant, then the remarriage also be based upon a covenant, but be a new covenant. Now let's look at Ezekiel 16. Chapter 16, verse 16. Nevertheless, I'll remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, establish unto you an everlasting covenant. Then shall you remember your ways and be ashamed when you shall receive your sisters, your elder sister and your younger, and I will give unto you for daughters, but not by your covenant. I'll establish my covenant with you. You shall know that I am Jehovah, that you may remember and be confounded, never open your mouth anymore, because of your shame, and I've forgiven you all that has been done, says the Lord Jehovah. And notice the focus here is the remarriage will be based upon a new covenant distinct from the old one, the new covenant. At that point, when the new covenant is finally applied to Israel, that's when there'll be a national regeneration and she'll finally be ashamed of her many adulteries. Let's go to Isaiah 54. Now, in the previous section, which happens to be Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13, through chapter 53, verse 12, what you have here is the most detailed prophecy of the Messianic program of death and resurrection. And it clearly is the most detailed prophecy about Messiah's sufferings and Messiah's death, and a clear implication of resurrection in two of these places. But as you read verses 1 through 9 of chapter 53, verses 1 through 9 of chapter 53, you will notice this is Israel confessing her sin of failing to recognize him when he first came. So he's quoting what Israel will say, in the day before the second coming. Israel is now confessing her sin of failing to recognize him when he first came. She says she thought he was suffering for his own sins, only now she realizes he suffered for their sins. And again, Israel's national salvation is the one prerequisite to the second coming. And in this passage, this is the confession they will make as a national salvation to bring him back. But that will lead to Israel's national salvation, and that will result in the events of chapter 54. In chapter 54, verses 1 through 3, she's told to expand her tent, pull out the, reach the specs, make it bigger, because to most of her history, she's produced illegitimate children. Now she'll begin to produce legitimate ones, and therefore make the abode much bigger than it's been before. Enlarge the house, more children are coming. And then in verses 4 through 8, he spells out the reasons. That's because her reunion and being remarried to her husband. So in verse 4, it says, all of her past adulteries will be forgotten. And that's what he says in verse 5, for your maker is your husband. Jehovah of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. There are many implications, by the way, of a plurality in the Godhead that doesn't come out in English renderings. This is one example, because in the Hebrew text in verse 5, both the word maker and the word husband is plural. Literally, for your makers is your husbands. One of those implications of plurality in the Godhead you can see in the Hebrew text, but not in the English text. But the key thing to note for our study right now is that she will again be related to God as a wife to the husband. Jehovah is your husband, and so in verse 6, there's now the calling of a once forsaken wife, now reunited. And so in verses 7 and 8, he says, all past forsakings will now be substituted by blessings. In the place of forsakings, in place of judgment, in place of discipline, there'll be blessings to come. Look at Isaiah chapter 62. Isaiah chapter 62, verse 5. Isaiah 62, verse 4. You shall no more be turned forsaken, neither shall your land any more be turned desolate. You shall be called Hephzibah in your land Beulah, for Jehovah delights in you, and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a virgin, so shall your sons marry you, and as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. And the picture is the people will be married to God, the land of the people also be married to God. So Israel is yet to have a much brighter future. One last passage, back to Hosea chapter 2. Entire context will summarize as verses 14 to 23, where we have the remarriage. He says in verse 14, therefore, behold, I'll allure her and bring her to the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. I will give her her vineyards from thence in the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she shall make answer there as in the days of her youth, in the days when she came up out of the land of Egypt. When he points out, she'll again be driven into the wilderness. And again, the Bible points out Israel as a nation will collapse to the midpoint of tribulation. There'll be one more forced exile for a period of 3.5 years, but then that's where he will woo her, court her again in the wilderness. And this time she'll respond properly. Literally, the Hebrew says he'll speak to her heart, And when she responds in verses 16 to 23, there'll be four specific results. The first result is in verse 16 and 17, a change in the Hebrew vocabulary. Verse 16, it shall be in that day, says Jehovah, you shall call me Ishi, shall call me no more Baalim, for I'll take away the names of the Baalim out of her mouth, they shall no more be mentioned by their name. He points out that God should no longer refer to God as Baalim, but as Ishi. Now, both words, by the way, in Hebrew simply mean my husband. In modern Hebrew, the main term used is Baalim. If an Israeli woman today speaks about a husband, she will say Baali. The only difference is a slight difference of meaning. Ishi means my husband in the sense of my man, and Baali means my husband in the sense of my master. But because Baalim, again the most common term in Hebrew today, is very similar to the word Baal, with whom she was guilty of committing so much adultery with, in the Hebrew language of the kingdom, the term Baali will be removed from Hebrew vocabulary. From then on, they only say Ishi, no longer use Baali to avoid any remembrance of one of the gods she was guilty of committing adultery with. The second result is in verse 18, she now have a land of peace and safety. Thirdly, in verses 19 and 20, there'll be a new betrothal. Shall again be betrothed. The word betrothed, notice, is used three times, but each of these times it emphasizes a different aspect. First of all, you'll be betrothed forever. That's the timing aspect. The second betrothed focuses on the content of this betrothal: righteousness, justice, loving kindness, and mercies. Righteousness, justice, loving kindness, and mercies. And the third betrothal emphasizes quality, faithfulness. Quality, faithfulness. And then the fourth result is in verses 21 to 23, the new meaning to the name Jezreel. In Hebrew, it's pronounced Israel with a Z, not an S sound like Israel. But it has a double meaning. It could mean either God scatters or God sows. God scatters or God sows. So during the period of punishment, she experienced Jezreel as God scattering, as the Jews were dispersed around the world. But now with the restoration, she'll experience Jezreel as go back into the promised land. They will now have all the promised land, settle all the promised land, and best of all, have peace in the promised land. So keep in mind, as the Bible describes Israel as the wife of Jehovah, describes her as the wife that became adulterated, undergoing punishment. Someday she will be reunited to her husband. Let's go deal with the second part of the outline. The church is the bride of the Messiah. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians 11. Chapter 11, verse 2, 1 Corinthians, that should be 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, for I'm jealous of you with a godly jealousy, for I espoused you to one husband, that I might present you as a pure virgin to Christ, a pure virgin to the Messiah. And the picture of the bride, the Messiah, is the same throughout the New Testament. A betrothed bride, not yet joined to her husband. A betrothed bride, not yet joined to her husband. She says, I espoused you, I betrothed you to one husband, the purpose to present you a pure virgin to the Messiah. And this now requires the process of sanctification. Now, the correlation between the Messiah and the bride of the church is often compared to the four key stages of the Jewish wedding system. Let me talk about these four stages, and then we'll see how all four steps are brought into being. The first stage is when the father of the groom made the arrangements with the father of the bride and paid the bride price. Again, the first stage, the father of the groom will make the arrangement with the father of the bride who paid the bride price. And sometimes the arrangement was made when there was just small children. And therefore, there'll be a long time between the first and second stage. There was always a minimum of 1 year, but sometimes it would be a lot longer. And because of that system, it would not be unusual for the man and the woman to meet for the first time on their wedding day. If you've seen the stage play, Fiddle on the Roof, I saw the movie. Tevye sings a song to his wife, "The first time I met you was on our wedding day." That was rather common. In fact, my grandparents met each other on the wedding day. The arrangement was made many years earlier, but they did not meet each other until the day of the wedding. Now, they must have gotten along because they produced 13 children. But that was when they first met. The second stage is called the fetching of the bride. The fetching of the bride. At some point, the groom will go to the home of the bride to fetch her to his home. Now, two elements here. First of all, it will not be the groom that will determine the time of the fetching. That's determined by the father of the groom, and the father will determine when to send his son to fetch the bride. And the second element involved here is this. The father will not send the groom to fetch the bride until the groom has prepared a place to bring the bride into. In ancient times, that was merely adding a room to the family compound. That would become the private chamber of this husband and wife. But the son must have this prepared before the father will choose the timing for the fetching of the bride. The third stage is the wedding ceremony, and only a few people would be invited to the wedding ceremony, and these are usually the close friends and relatives of the bride and the groom. Another aspect is this. Before the actual ceremony, the bride must go to a place called the mikvah, which is the place of immersion, to undergo ritual immersion from ritual uncleanness. After the immersion, she's brought to the place of the wedding ceremony. And the fourth stage will be the wedding feast. And many others will be invited to the wedding feast that were not invited to attend the wedding ceremony. And the wedding feast will last for the first 7 days of the marriage. That's for 7 days. Let's apply this to the relationship of the church and the groom. First of all, the arrangement. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. So husband loves your wives, even as the Messiah also loved the church and gave himself up for it, that he might sanctify it and cleanse it by the washing of the water with the word, that he might present the church to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but should be holy and without blemish. And the point here is that the arrangement has already been made by the father of the groom, and the father of the groom has already paid the bride price, which was also the price of the blood of his son. And that was the price for the marriage covenant. And the goal now is to sanctify the bride during this period between the first and second stage. She says the Messiah loves the church, he died for the church, now the goal is to sanctify the church, and the means is by the cleansing, by the washing of the water of the word, so that a time will come the church can be presented as glorious, without any defects, when the marriage ceremony comes. So it says without spot, there'll be no physical defilement, without wrinkle, there'll be no evidence of age or corruption, but the church will be holy, without blemish, no evidence of sin. And just as there can be a long time between the first and second stage, the same thing now has happened with us. It's been 2,000 years since the arrangement, and we're still waiting the second stage, the fetching of the bride. Now that will be the rapture of the church, which we already detailed on Sunday night. I will not repeat that, but let me point out to those two other elements. I guess not the son determines the timing of the fetching of the bride. That's done by God the Father. That'll be done by God the Father. And so at some point, God the Father will determine the timing of the fetching of the bride. And that's why even the Messiah said, the angels in heaven don't know when that event will occur. Even he does not know when the event occurred. That would be true of his humanity. That's in the hands of God the Father only. So only God the Father knows the timing of the fetching. Which raises a question in my mind. If the angels in heaven do not know the timing of the rapture, and even the Messiah himself in his humanity did not know the timing of that event, why is it that so many people writing books today know the timing of that event? They claim to have superior knowledge to the angels in heaven and the Son himself. But again, in the Jewish wedding system, the father will not send the son to fetch the bride until he has a place prepared for her. And that's what he's doing right now, and that's what we saw in the passage on Sunday night in John 14, verses 1 through 3. John 14, verses 1 through 3, he pointed out that he will soon be leaving them to go back to heaven, and while he is gone, he will be preparing a place for them. Only when the place is prepared will be able to come and fetch them. The timing of that sending will be in the hands of God the Father. But the fetching of the bride will be at the rapture of the church. Then we will have the wedding ceremony. We also noticed that already, but look for a moment to Revelation chapter 19. The wedding ceremony, we pointed out Sunday night, will take place in heaven before the second coming. It describes that in verses 6 to 8. Now mention that before the bride is brought to the chuppah, the canopy where the wedding takes place, she has to go to a place for ritual cleansing from ritual uncleanness. Now for the church, that will be the judgment seat of the Messiah, detailed in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 through 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 through 15. And every individual believer will be evaluated as how we served the Lord since we believed. It won't be water that will be the cleansing, but fire will be the cleansing. And all the wood, hay, stubble will be destroyed by the fire. All the gold, silver, precious stone will be cleansed by the fire. So that when the wedding ceremony takes place in verse 8, notice, all that she's dressed in fine linen, which he interprets to represent the righteous acts of the saints. And so what this means is that the process of sanctification will be complete at the judgment seat of the Messiah. At the wedding ceremony in heaven before the second coming, all that is showing on the bride will be the righteous acts of the saints. The fourth stage we mentioned is the wedding feast. And that's a separate event to which many others are invited. Look at verse 9, chapter 19, verse 9. He said unto me, write, blessed are they that are bidden to the marriage feast of the Lamb. At that point, in connection with the second coming, the invitation goes out to others. These others will be the resurrected Old Testament saints, resurrected tribulation saints. And the marriage feast will kick off the Messianic kingdom. And one motif the Bible uses as a symbol of the marriage feast, that symbolizes the kingdom is the marriage feast. One example is chapter 22 of Matthew. A third one is Matthew chapter 25. The wedding feast is a symbol of the Messianic kingdom. And therefore, for the first 7 days of the kingdom, there'll be the wedding feast of the Lamb. And so ultimately, the final home of the bride shall be on earth for the kingdom. The final home of the bride will be the eternal order described in chapter 21, verse 9 to chapter 22, verse 5. 21:9 to chapter 22, verse 5. And that'll be the eternal home. At that point, you will notice as you read, the bride is also called the wife. She's called the bride, but not called the wife, because this is now a final marriage relationship. So notice the differences in how the women are described between Israel as the wife of Jehovah, adulterated, waiting to be forgiven, to be remarried, but the church is a pure virgin, not yet joined to her husband, but someday will be. So just that one description, they cannot be the same woman. They simply cannot be the same woman. as one of the distinctives between Israel and the church. And so today we are the bride of the Messiah, already receiving the benefits of it, but the greater good is yet to come. Let me mention a few other. Starting with developing a commentary from a Messianic Jewish perspective on the whole Bible, we have one in the book of Genesis, which is this one also on the table. There's one on the book that covers Judges and Ruth. Another book covers what are called the Messianic Jewish Epistles, that covers Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, Jude, epistles written specifically to the remnant of Israel, the Jewish believers of that day. And there's also a paperback copy called Biblical Lovemaking. It's a literal interpretation of the Song of Solomon. That's what we call the Biblical Lovemaking. It has only words, no pictures. Now, one of I mentioned our program at Camp Shoshana is in a 5-year cycle. There's one course we teach every year, which is a 25-hour long version of The Life of the Messiah from a Jewish perspective. We now have this on DVD. The book is coming out sometime this summer, but right now it's available on DVD. It's available as study guides, you will see on the table, so you can get this whole 25-hour version right here. And let me also remind you that if you wish to possibly attend our summer program, you'll find these Camp Shoshana streets on the table. You can come either for 1 week up to 6 weeks, but the more you stay, it'll be cheaper from week to week, and then you get a lot of material, even if you've come for only 1 week. You get a lot of material that can use for the discipleship program. If you're looking for a place for yourself or for your children who are at least 18, for a special 1-year school program, this September will begin the Ariel School of Messianic Jewish Studies. There's brochures on this. We'll be limiting the student body initially for the first 2 years, at least to 25 students maximum. And so if you think you might want to attend or send somebody, you might want to get this information as soon as possible. Also, if anybody here has felt to make a regular monetary commitment to ministry, be sure to let us know what the amount is, and then fill out this form, tear it off, and either drop in the offering plate or leave it on the table. And if you also would like to receive our Bible Study magazine, now this we don't charge for, so if you wish to receive it, it comes out 4 times a year, containing at least two, usually three Bible studies. You can get it in 2 different ways. If you want a hard copy like this one, just give us your full name and address. If you prefer receiving it as an email, give us your email address. We'd be happy to send it to you that way, free of charge, as long as you want to receive it. All right, are we ready for the offer? Oh, they're ready this time. Finally, after 4 nights. I got 2 written questions here. Number one, last night you applied Jeremiah 31, 33 to 34 to Israel. I thought the new covenant mentioned here applies to the church. Would it be wrong to apply Jeremiah 31, 31, 34 to the church? Why or why not? Let's look at Jeremiah 31 once again. And he specifies who he's making the covenant with. He specifies who's it with. It specifies in chapter 31, verse 31, behold, the days come, said Jehovah, make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And the same people who made the Mosaic covenant, he also makes this covenant with. So it's a Jewish covenant as much as it's the Abrahamic covenant and the land covenant and the Davidic covenant. And that he did not make any of those covenants specifically with the church. How does the church benefit? We talked about this earlier in this conference, so let me just briefly repeat it. Looking at 3 passages. First of all, Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3. The key word Paul uses as to how the church relates to these covenants, it uses the word partaker. Partaker. And look at Ephesians chapter 3, verse 6, Ephesians 3, verse 6, the Gentiles are fellow heirs, fellow members of the body, fellow partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. Now, these Jewish covenants contain both physical promises and spiritual promises. The church does not partake of the physical promises, like the promise of the land. It does partake of the spiritual promises, like the promise in Christ Jesus. We, as the gospel, we are all saved, whether we're Jews or Gentiles. For also by means the indwelling of the Spirit applies to both Jewish and Gentile believers, because that's a new covenantal promise the church partakes of. So the key word that he uses is the word partaker and not taker over. That's the key. Now turn to Romans 11. The three places where he connects the Gentiles or the church with the Jewish covenants, that's the word he uses. But the church does not own the covenants. They simply partake of it. And that promise was already made in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. When God made Abraham a covenant, he told Abraham in verse 3 of chapter 12, "In you shall all the families of the earth be blessed." And the means of blessing is by partaking of the spiritual blessings. So in chapter 11, verse 17, 11, 17, "But some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive, was grafted in among them, to become partaker," there's the word again, "partaker with them," the Jewish branches, of the fatness of the olive tree. And so what you find is that both wild natural branches, Jewish believers, wild olive branches, Gentile believers, are partaking of the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. And the third passage is chapter 15. Notice the distinction he makes between the material and the physical blessings. Verse 27, Romans 15, 27, "Yea, it had been the good pleasure and the debtors the arm, if the Gentiles have been made partakers," again the same word, "of their," meaning Jewish spiritual things, "they owe it to them to minister unto them in material things." So notice when he talks about different kinds, he distinguishes the material from the spiritual, and what the church partakes of is the spiritual blessings, but not the material blessings. So you have to stay with what the text says. The covenant was not made with the church. It was made with Israel, but the church is participating in the blessings of the, partaking of the blessings of the covenant. Second question, Romans 2:26, Paul says the uncircumcision would be regarded as circumcision. What does Paul mean by regarded? Does God see me as a spiritual Jew based on my faith in Christ? Let's go to that passage, Romans chapter 2. What he does in the first three chapters is to emphasize that everybody is fallen short of God's righteousness. In chapter 1, verse 18, to the end of the chapter, he points out the pagan world, the pagan Gentile world, has fallen short of God's righteousness. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 16, 2:1-16, he shows how the cultured Gentile world also has fallen short. The Greek-Roman world were not paganized, they were quite cultured, but they too have fallen short. And if you think the Jews have not fallen short, from chapter 2, verse 17 to chapter 3, verse 20, 2:17 to 3:20, the Jews have also fallen short of God's righteousness. It's counteracting a common misconception that was taught by the teachings of the Pharisees, that the teaching was that, and I quote, "All Israel has a share in the age to come." All Israel had a share in the age to come. And therefore, anyone that is born a Jew would automatically enter into God's kingdom, while Gentiles would have to convert or live by the laws of Noah. Jews will qualify merely because they were born Jews. And therefore, circumcision was a sign of the Jewish identity. And the Jewish Talmud says that hell has no authority over anyone that is circumcised. Hell has no authority over anyone that is circumcised. And so if you're circumcised, you're going into the kingdom no matter how well or how bad you live. Now verse 24 5. For circumcision indeed profits if you are a doer of the law, but if you be a transgressor of the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. If therefore the uncircumcision keep the ordinances of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be reckoned as circumcision? Which not saying is that Gentiles become spiritual Jews. A spiritual Jew is a Jew who believes. If a Gentile believes, he's a spiritual Gentile. What he points out here is that's not circumcision that guarantees salvation, contrary to Pharisaic Judaism. Circumcision doesn't save anyone. Circumcision is important as for the entity of the Abrahamic covenant, important for Jewish identity, but it carries no spiritual value of salvation. So a circumcised person can be saved if he's circumcised. If he fails to believe, then his circumcision is just like uncircumcision, of no value. By the same token, if the uncircumcision, as the Gentiles, are believers, then they are viewed as being circumcised, receiving the benefit only because of what they believe. But he never refers to Gentile believers by being spiritual Jews or being Israel. But he points out that they become, it's not their circumcision or lack of circumcision that keeps them from getting saved. It's the lack of faith that keeps them from getting saved. If a Jew is circumcised, that doesn't guarantee his salvation either. He has to believe the gospel, otherwise there is no salvation. Okay, so any questions I got in the writing? We'll take questions from the floor for the next 11 minutes or so. Who's got the first question tonight?
Exodus 34, 10 through 28 talks about a covenant that the Lord makes with Moses. And one of the verses in it, verse 26, it mentions a phrase that's repeated a few other times about not boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. Why?
Yeah, it's mentioned three times in the Mosaic Law. The purpose of that law was to avoid a common Canaanite practice, that when a mother goat gave birth to its firstborn kid, they took the kid away from the mother, they would then milk the mother, they would boil the meat of the baby goat, the milk of its mother, as the first fruits offering to the god Baal or Baal. Jews could not practice that form of idolatry. Therefore, you don't see the kid in its mother's milk. The rabbis took that passage, developed a whole mass of laws about not mixing milk with meat. But he wasn't talking about mixing milk with meat. He was talking about avoiding a Canaanite worship practice. So that's why the law was spelled out three times.
Thank you so much for being here. I was wondering, what's your thoughts on where we are in the 70 weeks, Daniel's 70 weeks? I've heard two different schools of thought, one being there's 1 week left, and another being that the 70th ended when Stephen was stoned. And my second question is, how do we know from Mosaic Law what we're supposed to follow now?
Okay, first question on the 70 weeks. As you read that passage in Daniel 9, verses 24 to 27, he breaks out the 77s into three segments. There are seven sevens of 49 years, which is the period of time the city will be rebuilt. Now the 62 sevens of 434 years before the arrival of the Messiah. But he points out that after the second set of sevens, there's going to be a break where three things happen. Number one, Messiah's cut off. That happened in the year AD 30. Secondly, the destruction of Jerusalem. That happened AD 70. A long period of war and desolation. So you have 7 years left to run, but in verse 24, verse 27, he specifies the one event that will trigger the last 7 years, the signing of a seven-year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. Still living in the period between the 69th seven and the 70th seven. That's where we are now. And the last 7 years cannot start until there's the signing of a seven-year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. And it doesn't end with the stoning of Stephen, but ends only with the it starts only with the signing of the covenant. Because if you look at the purpose of 77ths, that's in verse 20, he relates six accomplishments, one of which is the Messianic kingdom. And if the 77ths ended with the stoning of Stephen, was the Messianic kingdom. Should have come after Stephen was stoned, and it never came. So 70, the 7 years of tribulation is the 70th week, and that hasn't begun yet. It won't begin till the covenant is signed. Your second question was what? Yeah.
Because 1 Corinthians, I believe, 11.
Yeah.
Because it's considered shameful, according to Brother Paul, for a woman to prophesy or pray in public without having her head covered. Likewise, shameful for a man to have a head covered. How do we know what we're supposed to follow here in the 21st century from the Mosaic law?
First of all, you don't follow, you're not required to follow anything from the Mosaic Law. That Mosaic Law came to an end with the Messiah's death. You can use your freedom in the Messiah to keep certain commandments that do not violate the New Testament. But if the New Testament is neutral, if you wish to continue to follow them, that's fine. But the law that we're under now is called the law of the Messiah. And just like the Mosaic law had a total of 613 commandments, also hundreds of commandments, the law of the Messiah. And God, he begins to give some of these laws after Matthew 12. Matthew 12 and 13 is where Israel rejects him as the Messiah. So he begins to give us commandments to be applicable once he dies, is raised, and is ascended. So on one hand, you have the commandments that begins to give, like in the Upper Room Discourse in John 14 through 16, 17, and so on. Those are all applicable for us today. In addition to the laws that he himself gave us, he also gave us laws by means of his apostles. So the rules we have in the epistles and so on apply to us. So those are the laws, the rule of life we have to follow. Now let me the specific point about the head covering. For most of church history, it was taken to be part of a commandment. In the last, in the last century, started moving away from it. It depends where you take that to be applicable, or is it just cultural? Now, those who take it cultural say it doesn't apply to us today. My problem with that interpretation is, if the issue is cultural, Paul gives cultural reasons. He talks about meat sacrificed to idols. It's a cultural issue. It says, if you eat that meat, if somebody will stumble, then refrain. All the reasons he gives in 1 Corinthians 11 are theological reasons that will still apply. So my wife and I do follow that principle. If my wife was here, she would have her head covered. But it's not an issue worth splitting a church over or leaving a church over. So if you feel that's what the text teaches, you should come and keep your head covered. If other women feel otherwise, don't judge them. But so my wife follows. When I go to Messianic congregation, which is my own, I don't wear a head covering for that same reason. Question?
In Revelation 21:9, is the bride the same bride mentioned in verse 2?
What he does in the book of Revelation is identified the person with the city the person is dwelling in. In fact, he did that earlier. If you look at chapter 17 of Revelation, he talks about the great harlot, the world religion. He describes the religious system in chapter 17, verses 1 through 17. And then he says in verse 18, the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth, which is Babylon. And in chapter 18, he begins to focus on Babylon. He identifies the religion of Babylon with the city of Babylon, which should be the religion in the tribulation period. What he does in chapter 21 and 22 is the eternal home of the bride will be the eternal New Jerusalem. So he does, as he did with Babylon in chapter 18, he does with this. the bride will live in Jerusalem, and therefore the city is the home of the bride, and therefore the two are connected. So here the city itself is viewed as being the bride. But the bride is also the church, as we saw in Ephesians 5. But the eternal abode of the bride will be the New Jerusalem after the Messianic Kingdom. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? Well, thank you for the conference. Thank you for your many years of our relationship. I won't be doing any more itineraries. I may come back for short itineraries if it works out, but the long itineraries will not be doing anymore since the school is starting. I have to be on campus to deal with the students. So I'm not retiring. I don't plan to retire until I'm physically incapacitated. But just my job description is changing. I'll still be very active.